Hi, I'm Sam, and I'd like to welcome Richie Furay, a member of Buffalo Springfield, Poco, and a person who was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for Buffalo Springfield. So welcome, Richie. Well, the song For What It's Worth has become an extremely relevant anti-war song since its release years and years ago. So when you released that song with Springfield, did you know it would make that much of an impact?
I had no idea. It went right over my head, not for the lyrical content, but for the musical content. I mean, we had already, you know, we were doing Mr. Soul and Blue Bird and Rock and Roll Woman, and we were doing all these rock and roll songs, and all of a sudden Steven comes up with this nice little folk song. And it was like, are you kidding me, man? But Ahmet Erdogan was there. What we were doing is I won't say auditioning, but we were auditioning songs for a second Buffalo Springfield record. And, when everyone got through, Steven played some songs, Neil played some songs, I played some songs, and we're packing up our guitars, and Steven says, oh, I have another one for What It's Worth. And that was it. And Ahmet said, that's got to be a hit record, man. And so we went ahead and did it. So, but at the time, just simply because it was just this nice little folk song, you know, I was like, I was past that.
So you weren't a fan when you first heard it?
Not when I first heard it. I mean, I thought, sure, it was a nice song, but I didn't think, golly, it's a hit record. But, you know, Ahmet Erdogan, you know, he certainly thought that it was a hit, and he's had a pretty sharp ear. So we obviously went with it, and it was the highest recorded record we ever made.
Well, can you tell me about the recording process of that song?
I'm trying to go back to that. That's a long time ago. You're asking me, man, to dip way back. But, we recorded it, I believe, at Gold Star, and it probably was recorded on four-track, like most of the other recordings that we did at Gold Star for the first record, anyway, were. And I'm thinking that we just went in the studio and we laid down a track, and then we got in and we just, you know, we sang it. I think I got some photos, or there are some photos going around of Dewey and Steven and Neil and me, Steven and I, at least, doing background vocals on the song. And so it was pretty simple in those days, because it was a four track, you know? So, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how have you felt like watching that song evolve into just like being, you know, because a lot of songs tend to die out, but this song has stayed, and it has remained the greatest protest songs of all time. How has that made you feel just watching it, you know, stay in relevance?
Well, it certainly is the national anthem of protest songs today. Yeah, there's nothing I can think of that really comes close to it. And, you know, who would have guessed it? Who would have known? I mean, other than Ahmet, I sure didn't. And you know, the fact that it's still played today, and interestingly enough, it didn't have anything to do with war. People think that it had something to do with the Vietnam War, and it didn't. It had to do with a situation that was located in Los Angeles, where Laurel Canyon and Sunset Boulevard and Crescent Heights all come together, and there was a club there that the police were shutting down because they thought that it was a hazard to the traffic and all. And so then it just took off. I mean, it was a protest song of sorts, but everybody now just, whatever I got to protest, you know, you can hear the ding.
Yeah, well, I guess that's how songs evolve, right? They get new contexts, new things that give them life.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know something that was really interesting to me about Springfield is that your band was from both Canada and the U.S., which, you know, you don't see often when you're looking at bands. It's like, okay, this is an American band, this is a British band, this is a Canadian band. What was there any, like how did you guys being from different countries affect the style of music that you did?
You know, I didn't even think about that. And the way the band came together, Steven and I were in a folk group. And when that group broke up, Steven took off with a portion of that band and did a little tour of Canada because he wanted to go to California. And it was there that he met Neil up in Toronto. And that's where that friendship really became a strong friendship. And so that's how it happened. But at the time, you know, it didn't even faze me that Neil and Bruce and Dewey were all Canadians. You know, hey, they're just musicians just like us, and we're just putting this thing together.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, did you guys all have different influences and different styles of playing because of where you grew up, or did it just not affect it at all? Because I mean, I guess they're both North America.
Yeah, I don't think it did affect us. I mean, you know, Neil had his, well, we each had maybe a different style or a style of our own, but when it melded together, it became Buffalo Springfield. But it wasn't like someone was a dramatic, heavy duty blues guy, you know, and the other guy was a country guy, you know. I mean, it was just kind of music that was happening. It was a great time to be making music in the late 60s and early 70s. I mean, you could experiment with so many different kinds of music and just put them together, and we just happened to click.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I ask you here, when Buffalo Springfield all started up, what were your first impressions on all the different members?
Well, Bruce, very eccentric guy. Neil, I had met Neil in New York. Stephen had told him to come down because he came down at one point in time to peddle some songs. And he played me, you know, quite a few songs that, I know Clancy ended up on the very first record, and probably some of the other ones, but that one stuck out in my mind. And I just thought, you know, this guy is a very unique songwriter and very outgoing and personable at the time. I think Neil over time kind of withdrew a little bit, you know, because of the mystique that is around him. But, you know, I certainly thought that he was a pretty neat guy, and I still like him a lot. You know, I mean, we got along, even though, you know, we had our differences, and kind of confused me sometimes when he decided he didn't want to be in the band anymore. I think Neil always wanted to be a solo artist, and he was using different, you know, opportunities to launch that career. Stephen and I really had a great friendship from, you know, just being in the Agogo Singers together. And and Dewey, you know, who would have thought, you know, that this guy that played all this country music and then came out and was playing with the Dillards when they thought that they wanted to maybe add a bass and drums to their format, and decided, no, nah, this isn't working. We're more of a bluegrass band. And so he was recommended, and just a very outgoing guy. I mean, everybody was really friendly. It was kind of, you know, it was a unique situation for sure, because obviously we came from very different backgrounds and all, but it worked, you know. It worked for 2 years, and then that was it. It was done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, why do you think it was such a short-lived group?
Well, number one, I really do believe this. One of the reasons was because Neil, I don't think he ever really wanted to be in a band. I think he always wanted to have a solo career. And, you know, Bruce had drug problems and, you know, he would get deported, and we would take one step forward and get knocked back two steps. And I think that was really the crux of the whole matter, you know. It's why we couldn't really get anything going. We're always trying to teach the old songs to new guys. And then, you know, when one of the other guys decided, hey, listen, you got to come back. And so, you know, when all that happened, it was just hard to get any momentum going. Mm-hmm. And then Neil had a different view. At least that's what I understand from just some of the things. I've never really talked to him about it, but from his perspective, like when we went to New York one time to do a Johnny Carson show, he didn't want to, I mean, he just didn't show up. He didn't show up at the airport to leave. And he had different ideas. It was difficult. You know, it was, there were 9 people in the band in 2 years, the 5 original and then 4 replacements in 2 years. And that, I think, really had a lot to do with the reason that we just couldn't make any momentum or get any momentum going.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, did you ever get like frustrated? It sounds just like, well, one of your members not showing up at the airport, that would bother me a little bit, but...
Well, it was frustrating. Obviously it was. I mean, the only place I think we ever got fired from a band was in Boston. I mean, from a club was in Boston when Neil didn't show up for that one trip that we took, you know, and 4 of us were playing. And I think after the first night, the guy came and said, hey, you guys don't need to come back tomorrow night. Oh. I mean, the one guy could make such a big difference, you know, but it was a unique situation. Yeah, it was frustrating. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, such is life. And in the end, you know, when I always said I'll be in the band as long as Steven's there, because Steven was the heart and soul of the band. No, there's no, you just can't, you can't move around that or past that. It was his band. And because of, I guess, our friendship, I said, as long as he's there, I'll be there. And when he decided, you know, hey, it's over, then fortunately, you know, we had Jimmy Messina became our last bass player. And Jimmy and I struck up a real close friendship, obviously.
Yeah, and I mean, didn't the two of you went off to do your own like little more country influenced rock, right? You did Poco.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how different was that in comparison to Buffalo Springfield? Like the playing wise, how did, I guess, the music, how did it feel different?
Well, Jimmy had quite a, I mean, I think James Burton had a big influence on Jimmy's guitar playing. And, you know, we both had, you know, a love for country music. My dad listened to a lot of country music when I was growing up. And so sitting in the back of my mind someplace, you know, there was that country, you know, that movement. And so together, we just kind of had that thought, let's try and combine, you know, the music of today in Los Angeles, which, I mean, golly, you had everything from the Beach Boys to the Turtles to Buffalo Springfield to the Doors to all the, but let's, that's what I say, man, there was so much experimenting that you could do, and everybody was just open arm to, you know, to listen. But Jimmy and I just decided, let's try and cross country and rock and, you know, see what we come up with. It was nothing new. I mean, Gene Vincent and Carl Perkins and Buddy Holly and those type of guys were doing it, you know, years and years before we, you know, it's like, what was it called back then? It was rockabilly. And that's what a lot of the things they were doing. But we were, you know, there was a couple of us that were doing that at the time in Los Angeles. Obviously, Graham Parsons, you know, was doing something similar, but you can ask Chris Hillman if you ever get a chance to talk to him. He says, man, we weren't a country rock band. We were a country band. You know, we played all the country dives in Los Angeles and, but we're Poco, you know, we definitely wanted to make a, we wanted to cross. We wanted to cross over and try and get accepted in that way in both areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you tell me where that name came from?
Oh gosh. It was the hardest thing for us at the time to just come up with a name. And a guy that was working as our manager at the time, I guess he was into that little swamp character called Pogo. And because there's what we started the band as Pogo, not Poco. And Walt Kelly, who wrote the comic strip character, he sent us a little note that was about an inch thick and said, get out of my tree. In other words, we were being sued.
Uh-oh.
To use the name. And we'd already established such a, you know, a following out in Los Angeles. So, oh, golly, we're going to have to change our name. And fortunately, somehow or another, and I don't know who came up with the idea, but let's just take the line off the G and call it Poco.
Well, I mean, if it sticks and it works, it works, right?
And it stuck for, I mean, it's stuck forever. Yeah. I mean, Poco really had a great following, and the following, you know, obviously, Rusty Young carried on the, you know, the legacy of Poco right up until a couple years ago when he died.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you ended up going off with like Chris Hillman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did that separation go? How did you end up going a different direction after Poco?
I was frustrated. Mm-hmm. You know, I that's basically the bottom line of it. You know, we could not break into AM records or radio. And that really was the catalyst to really push somebody to the next level. And we just could, I mean, we could go out and we could play any auditorium, you know, or college campus, wherever we went, you know, and just have a everybody. I mean, it was just wonderful. It was great. We had a great audience, but we couldn't crack the hit record that would launch us. And when we released Good Feeling to Know, we all thought that, hey, this was going to be the song that launched us. Interestingly enough, at the same time, a group called the Eagles came out with Take It Easy. And that just kind of you know, kind of pushed us into the background, and I got frustrated, and I just left. I had, you know, we'd had a friendship with a guy named David Geffen, and I talked to David and said, hey man, you know, I don't think it's going to work for Poco, and he was actually involved with us and with the Eagles, and so many other people around that time, Jackson Brown and Linda Ronstadt and other people at the time. But he said, well, listen, I know that Chris Hillman's looking for something to do. And J.D. Souther, who, you know, a really good songwriter and all, you know, he's looking for something to do. Why don't we just put together another Crosby, Stills, and Nash? And I'm thinking, what? I mean, I've been at this for 6 years now, and this is all it's going to take, you know. But anyway, Chris and J.D. and I got together, and it became a Souther, Hillman, Fure band, which was short-lived as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, of all your music career, is there like one thing that you're most proud of doing?
Well, you know, if I had to think maybe one thing, we did, Poco, start a genre of music, pioneered it, dug up the fallow ground, you know, the hard stuff. And though we did not have the commercial success, it opened the door for, I think, one of America's greatest bands. You know, obviously, I supplied two bass players for them and all. But I think, you know, as I look back, you know, that would have to be one thing that I would definitely say was pretty cool. You know, I mean, at the time, we didn't know we were going to start a genre of music that was going to, we were just living our, this is our music, you know, this is what we do. But it turned out to be, you know, I mean, let's face it, the Eagles, man, they took it to the limit.
Yes, yeah, so, you know, yeah, they sure did. Well, I know you mentioned a little bit beforehand that when you were little, your dad would listen to all this country music. Was that a major influence on you with like everything you did?
I think it had to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it had to be. You know, I mean, I was just into those guys. I mentioned Gene Vincent, Buddy Holly, Carl Perkins, Ritchie Valens, Buddy Holly. You know, those were the kind of music that I wasn't into the very straight country music, you know, but these guys that were playing that rockabilly stuff, you know, and then of course, Ricky Nelson, he had a big influence on my life. I don't know if you ever watched the Ozzy and Harriet show or even know who they are, but they had a big television show. It was the Nelson family. Mm-hmm. I couldn't wait for the end of the show for Ricky to come on. And cause at the end of every show, you know, he would come on and sing a song. And it was like, man, if he can do that, it didn't even dawn on me. Okay, this guy's in a Hollywood family, and he, you know, his dad's a big music guy and producer, and this and that and the other. His mom was a singer in the band, and they're on television. But if he can do that, I can do it too.
Oh, so was that was the point you wanted? You knew you wanted to be a musician.
Yeah, I think around that time, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just, but I tell you, when he did this one of these shows, his brother David, I think, had a baby, and he was in the bedroom over the crib with his guitar, just singing his song called Bebop Baby. And by the time he got to the third verse and all, it switched to the gym, the high school gymnasium, and there was a whole band there, and it was like, oh my gosh, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I mean, what was your first like music experience yourself? Like the first thing you ever played? Do you remember like what song that might have been?
No, I was into a lot of, interestingly enough, a lot of doo-wop music, you know, like Dion and the Belmonts. And mm-hmm. But that was just one of the commercial acts that I liked. And in high school, you know, there were three guys that were upperclassmen that were my doo-wop guys. You know, they sang the backgrounds, and I was their little Anthony, if you want to use little Anthony Imperials, you know. And that's how my girlfriend and I got into the high school dances. But I can't remember any of the songs that we did, but a lot of doo-wop music that was happening at the time.
That's funny. So do you think doo-wop ended up like making its way into any of your future music business, or was it just something you left in the dust?
I don't think it did.
Back to the Buffalo Springfield side of your music story. You reunited with Stephen Stills and Neil Young. Just how long ago was that?
You know what? It was about 10 to 12 years ago.
10 years ago.
Yeah, but we did that reunion. Of course, Bruce and Dewey had passed away, and Joe Vitale and Rick Rosas, who also now Rick's passed away. But yeah, we tried to do a reunion in the 80s, late 80s, and it was a train wreck. It was awful, and that never got off the ground. And then, you know, back about 10, 12 years ago, you know, Neil got in touch with me and said, hey, would you like to come out and do the Bridge School concert, you know, and all? And he said, I think Stephen would like to do it if you want to do it. And I thought, yeah, man, this would be fun. I've been wanting to do that for a long time. And so, yeah, that put us together. And you know what was interesting about that reunion? It was like a hand in a glove. I mean, it was like we hadn't even left. I mean, we just picked it up and we started playing, and it was just real smooth, and it was a lot of fun. And we did the two nights at the Bridge School, and then we did three cities the next year. We played, I think, in Oakland, it's Oakland, Los Angeles, and in Santa Barbara. And then we did Bonnaroo, and bam, it was done. That was it. And it was interesting. After every one of those shows that we did, we all got together, you know, after the show, and just kind of, yeah, that was fun. That was great. You know, after Bonnaroo, I never saw anybody.
Oh, wow.
Everybody went to their own bus, and that was it.
Oh, geez.
So I know.
Well, were you surprised at all that Neil was the one who reached out and like initiated this whole thing? Because from what you've said before, it sounds like he was the least band like centric member out of all of you.
Because of the success that Neil has gotten over the years, and certainly he took off in such a, you know, spectacular way. He's the one that actually called me when Buffalo Springfield was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He called and said, hey, man, I'm so proud of you. We're going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame together. Now, he'd already been inducted maybe at one time. And it was just an exciting thing that he reached out. But then, you know, just maybe about 2 months or a month before, you know, the actual event, I got a fax. Not coming. Surprise. And you know, he had his reasons, and so if you watch any of the old video, you know, we kind of all talk about that a little bit during the induction and all. But he was the one that reached out, and he reached out for the I think it was neat that he did, because I think he would have been the one. Like, had Stephen come and said, well, I haven't talked to Neil yet to know if he, but if Neil was in, then we probably, everybody would be in, you know, or at least be willing to get in and do it. But the other way around, I don't know if it would have worked or not.
Wow. That's interesting. Well, Richie, it's been a pleasure talking to you here and hearing all about your music story. It's just been fascinating. I love hearing music stories, stories behind the songs, stories about the artists, all that. It's just so interesting to hear. And you know, your story was no exception. I loved hearing about Springfield and Poco and, you know, everything musical you've done. So thank you so much for talking.
Quite a journey, man. Hey, thanks, Sam.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm Sam Padore, and I hope you enjoyed that interview with Richie Furé. Richie was a member of Buffalo Springfield and Poco, and you know, he just had so much cool stuff to say about both of those bands. So if you did enjoy that interview, make sure to check out mybackpages.org to hear many great interviews just like this one.